Jeff Norman, the Norman Report.
Good evening, everybody. Jeff Norman on the Norman Report. It must be Wednesday, 7 o'clock Pacific time, 10 o'clock Eastern time. And in New Zealand, it's sometime in mid-August. Maria Armudian, one of my favorite people in the world, will be speaking with us shortly from New Zealand. She is a media expert and an all-around well-rounded scholar. In fact, she hosts a show called The Scholars Circle. And can you believe she's consented to speak with me anyway?
You are so lucky.
Geza X is with me. Geza X, what can we say about Geza? He's a punk rock icon, he's a cultural critic, and he has a brand new haircut. Can we get a close-up on that, Jeremy? Look at that. He looks like he's in the Marines.
And you're lucky that I've consented to speaking with you today.
I do feel lucky. Very fashionable eyeglasses. I don't know if your average Marine would wear that.
99 cents at the dollar store.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, then you underpaid by one penny. You better get back there and...
It looks similar to your glasses, actually, except they're red.
Yeah, similar. So Donald Trump has been the topic of pretty much everything everywhere, including this show, and why should tonight be any different? Maria is going to be speaking with us about media coverage of not only Trump, but the political situation in general. And that was all set. And then Trump pulled yet another surprise move. He withdrew from the debate.
Yes, he did. Flagrantly and flamboyantly.
Flagrantly and flamboyantly. Like
the necessary two Fs.
So what do you think about that, Geza? You know, all my Facebook friends are saying he's a coward.
Oh, my God.
You think that's a fair assessment?
No. I think, as a matter of fact, that he's a brilliant showman and that he always weighs his options and he tries to figure out win-win for Trump. In other words, if there's like three options, he tries to arrange it and orchestrate the whole situation so that no matter what happens, he cannot lose, because that's what a negotiator like him is always trying to stay ahead of the curve and do.
Yeah, I mean, I think coward is something that it's like a schoolyard taunt, and that's what he does. And it doesn't mean that it's interesting analysis just because he does it. You know, maybe it, in a sense, it fits the dictionary definition of being afraid, you know. But, I mean, you could always say somebody's afraid, but what's the difference between being afraid and making a decision that it's not the best move for you? You
know, correct. You know what I mean? And furthermore, they were telling, you know, the media was making a pretty big spectacle out of the thought that Trump has somehow gotten his feelings hurt. And that these hurt feelings are so unprofessional and unseemly. And actually, I think that for him to get his feelings hurt would take an awful lot, because he's used to dealing with some very, very heavy people. And to negotiate the way that he does, obviously he needs to have a thick skin. So I don't think that it was the slightest bit of a bother to him, but it looked like an opportunity for him to pull out if he felt like maybe he was going to be not doing so good in this next debate. He could make it look like it was a situation that that was going to eventually favor him. And I think there's a lot of plotting and planning that goes on step by step as this thing is unfolding.
Well, you know, he's a complicated character, and one way to look at it is he blurs the lines. You know, there are a lot of people who have done that, you know, whether it's Andy Kaufman or Howard Stern. They blur the line in the sense that sometimes they're comedic, sometimes they're serious, and very often you can't tell what the difference is. I think sometimes you can't tell whether what Trump said is something that he planned in advance and it's very strategic, or if it's improvisational. I mean, he does both, but you can't always tell which is which. So I think what you just said makes sense, but, you know, it may be that he's also somewhat offended.
Well, I mean, I think improvisational is probably the best word possible here, because when you are a jazz musician and all your entire, thing is improvising, after many years of doing that and learning your scales rigidly and learning exactly how all the different music works and learning all the standards so you can mess with them, I think that kind of improvisation becomes second nature. And that after a while, you simply can't make a mistake. You could play and play and play all night, and no matter what note you hit, no matter how far outside it is, and definitely Trump is the outside jazz variety of
It's politician. A weird analogy, but I buy it. You know, it makes sense.
Thanks.
So I mean, you know, the nature of politics is it has to be improvisational. And I think improvisational jazz musicians, they don't just, you know, come and you know, blow their notes randomly. There is some foundation to it.
Definitely.
So Rush Limbaugh was saying that Trump, of course, or not of course, but he could very well be thinking ahead to the general election. Not that it's the only thing he's thinking, but that's part of the mix. So when he chooses to amp up the war with Fox News, he might be taking hits right now. People are saying he's cowardly and this and that. But there's also some benefit to it in the sense that some of the broader audience, you know, the Democrats, the middle of the road people, they don't like Fox News.
Right.
So it's good for Trump to have the perception that he's the enemy of Fox News.
Of their enemy.
Yeah. So that's one thing that's going on. Another is that it keeps the attention on Trump. That's pretty obvious.
The whole story's been about him.
Yeah. And then there's more or less the conventional sort of old fashioned interpretation, which everybody does, which is if you're the leader, it's very common in politics that you're much less eager to debate than the challenger who needs to debate to catch up. It's their opportunity. So, you know, you wouldn't normally say somebody is, cowardly. Well, you might, but you would be doing the schoolyard taunt thing. It wouldn't be the full analysis of it. And what a lot of people don't realize, especially Bernie Sanders fans, the Sandersnistas, and I think it kind of got lost in the news because of this Trump thing, but Sanders is saying he won't participate in the New Hampshire debate on February 4th unless it's sanctioned by the DNC, whereas O'Malley and Clinton say they'll do it. And, gee, do you think the reason might be because Sanders is ahead in New Hampshire? And how many of these people are calling Sanders a coward?
Right.
About zero, right?
Right.
Maybe even negative integers.
Yeah, I didn't see that one, but I hear you.
Right. All right, so let's hear it from Trump himself. This he was on with Bill O'Reilly tonight, but it was just right before we went on the air, so we don't have footage of it yet. But let's play a clip from a press conference yesterday, Trump himself explaining why he's pulling out of the debate.
Fox is going to make a fortune. I told Fox you should give money to the Wounded Warriors. I'm not a fan of Megyn Kelly. I think she's a third-rate reporter. I think she, frankly, is not good at what she does. And I think they could do a lot better than Megyn Kelly. And so I'm going to be making a decision with Fox, but I probably won't bother doing the debate. I see they picked me as number one. Not only number one by far, but probably I won't be doing the debate. I didn't like the fact that they sent out press releases talking about Putin and playing games. I don't know what games Roger Ailes is playing, but what's wrong over there? Something's wrong. But when they sent out that press release talking about, I said, what are these people playing games? So most likely, I won't be doing the debate. See, the point is that with me, they're dealing with somebody that's a little bit different. They can't toy with me like they toy with everybody else. So let them have their debate, and let's see how they do with the ratings. And I told them, I said, give money to the Wounded Warriors, give money to the veterans. They're going to make a fortune with the debate. Now let's see how many people watch. We'll have our own event. We'll raise some money for the Wounded Warriors. We'll raise money for the vets. But when they sent out the wise guy press releases a little while ago, I was all set to do the debate. I came here to do the debate. When they sent out the wise guy press releases a little while ago, done by some PR person along with Roger Ailes, I said, bye-bye.
All right, so let's go to New Zealand, where I think it's mid-August on a Friday, and Maria Armudian, who is the host of the Scholar Circle, which airs on 10 radio stations. Her website is armudian.com. And she is the author of Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World. And she is a lecturer at the University of Auckland. Maria, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
Hi, Jeff. It's so great to talk with you.
Oh, stop. That's what I was going to say about you. So what Trump just said, I think, is an excellent segue into speaking with you, in particular the comment about how you can't mess, says something like, you can't mess with me like with other people. And one of the reasons you can't mess with him is because of what the media landscape has become. There is a blog post that I want to recommend called American Spring, and it's at startupboy.com. And the author is, his name is Naval, and I'll get his last name before we're done. He's an entrepreneur and a major angel investor who's well known in that world. And he wrote a very interesting blog post a few days ago in which he was talking about how social media has really changed the game. You know, people kind of realize it kind of halfway, I think. But he was saying it's really revolutionized the thing, and it's kind of like cut out the middleman, so to speak. People don't need to go through the gatekeepers nearly as much anymore. They can have direct access to the audience. And I think Trump is benefiting from the times. You know, more than anybody else, he knows how to use social media. And that's part of the reason that he can play hardball with the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers are still in the game when it comes to TV and movies. But you see, nobody has ever toyed with them. They're toying with him, but he's toying with them. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about just, you know, Trump in particular, but in general, how you feel about that premise. Is the new media, has it really revolutionized the thing where it's now a whole new form of democracy now and for the better? What do you think?
Well, I do think it's making a big impact. I think that those candidates who know how to use it and have been able to use it to their advantage are then getting the attention of what we call legacy media, traditional media. But it's really it all matters. One feeds the other. Mainstream media pulls information off of the Twitter feeds and the Facebooks and all of the other modes of communication, just like what we tweet and what we post also comes from the traditional legacy media. So it's all what we call a construction of what is in the public sphere. So what is the information in the public sphere and what is dominant? Then what is dominant tends to get replayed over and over and over again, these like memes, right? These catch on, especially in the age of such competition between so many different media outlets to get attention, because there's so much more competition. So they try to grab the most attention-getting thing. Now, Trump, let's play with him a little bit in this. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a master of these sound bites, of saying that very thing that gets attention. He's a master of being a spectacle, being a character, putting on a show. That's perfect for all of these media, including Twitter, where you can only use, you know, a few characters to get your point out. But traditional media, the sound bites have gone from very long to extraordinarily short, and scholars have measured exactly how short they've gotten. He's a master at this. He's a master at building a persona, putting on a show, entertaining, which says also what has happened to our public affairs media. It's blended with entertainment. Everything, like you were talking about this blend.
Yeah, blurring the line. Yeah, that's another good
blurring
example.
Blurring the line. Right. So it's not just the people like Howard Stern and Donald Trump who are blurring the lines. It's traditional media that is now blurring the lines without telling you. So they completely gravitate to a candidate like Donald Trump because he is entertaining. And so they have been part of the creation of this Trump machine. What he's done in pulling out of the debate, first of all, you're right. He doesn't really need it. It might affect him. We don't know yet exactly how people will respond. Mm-hmm. Conservatives tend to respond differently than liberals. But the other thing is that this is part of the show. This is part of him saying, I'm Donald Trump. Look at how strong I am. Let me beat my chest. Is it this interesting? He, again, doesn't have to buy political ads because guess what? Right. He's on everybody's television
right.
screen.
It's like professional wrestling, because you know how professional wrestling, they're always right. having some feud. And so this feud between Trump and Fox News, it really reminds me of these fake fights they have in professional wrestling.
Absolutely. Let me say a little bit more about this, because you're exactly on to what scholars have been talking about for a very long time.
Oh, does that mean I'm a scholar in the making?
You're enticing, absolutely.
Good.
So there are four general media biases that are not partisan biases. And the most important one is the conflict bias. Where there's a conflict, media go. So suppose we were at a ball game, and the entire arena is full of people watching the ball game, but a fight breaks out in a corner, guess where the media go?
Right.
So
that's what Trump says goes on at the at his rallies when the protesters start disrupting it. That's when the cameras show the crowd. He says they won't show how big the crowd is unless there's a disruption in the audience.
Right, right. But it also, like, he knows how to capitalize on that because he is a conflict candidate. He's a guy who likes conflict, and therefore it serves the media's effort because where do our eyeballs go to?
Right. Now, you're talking about the way the media covers characters like Trump, but what about the media commentators themselves? I mean, would you agree they're kind of blurring the line as well, just in the way they host their shows and so forth? Like, Megyn Kelly is having this feud with Donald Trump. I don't know how familiar you are with Megyn Kelly, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you are, I'd like to know what you think about her. And if not, in general, you know, what do you think about these hosts?
So let's talk about their content before we talk about their persona, because media could play a very important role in democratic settings. And you and I have talked about this in the past,
right,
Jeff. So the ideas that, if you look historically about how democracy could work, is that media give you an independent analysis of what these policy positions would mean that the candidates put forth. Boy, when I look at the American media and the landscape of what they're talking about, it is very difficult to find one policy position, one analysis, anything independent. Almost every host is talking not about those things that are going to affect our lives, they're going to affect our health, they're going to affect our education, and affect life and death for many people. No, what they talk about is personality. They talk about the conflict, and they talk about, most often, the horse race. Who's ahead? Who's behind? Who's ahead? Who's behind? How's the campaign going? What's this person doing? What's the strategy? Who's ahead? And these are, it's like they're reporting on a sports event.
Yeah.
And what's happening to democracy in the meantime is nobody knows anything. There's a concept I just want to briefly talk about here that we use when we teach media and politics, and that's called priming. Excuse me. Priming. Notice I'm not letting you get a word in edgewise. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm not a full scholar yet. I'm studying while you're talking.
Priming is when media give their audiences the criteria by which to judge their candidates or their government. And what American media have mostly been doing is giving us what kind of criteria for judging our candidates, their personalities, how well their campaigns are. They're not giving us a single substantive thing to grab a hold of. And so nobody thinks about, well, what's going to happen to, you know, a particular policy, environmental policy, education policy, healthcare policy, foreign policy. Nobody's thinking about these things. And then when we hear in the debate somebody making a ridiculous claim, I'm not even going to repeat some of them. I'm not going to do it. I was going to, but I refrain.
You got to draw the line somewhere, you know.
But when they, instead of getting independent analysis about, is this feasible? How would this work? It's he said, she said, he said, she said. And so if the media end up becoming, you know, like I said, like sports announcers.
Now, when you say the media, you're referring to all media, most media. I mean, you know, I don't want to be overly literal here. There are exceptions, right?
Of course, absolutely. But look, you know, I mean, I'm in New Zealand, and so I don't get everything that you get there in the U.S. since I've been here teaching. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm a regular reader of the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
and the New York Times front page every day usually has something on the horse race.
Right.
Now, you can look a little bit deeper, and when you look a little bit deeper, you can start to get a little bit of analysis of policy positions. But it's mostly, even in the newspaper that is supposed to serve sort of the intellectual crowd, it still is mostly horse race politics, unfortunately.
Right. And by your tone, it's obvious you don't think this is a good thing. But and I don't disagree in general, but I do think there is a positive side to it, and I want to ask you about it. Now, you were talking about the New York Times, but that's a step above the tabloids, which are even more tawdry and more gossipy and so forth. I think there's a positive side to that, which is that it draws more people into the process. I mean, you know, we want, it's good for democracy to have as many people involved as possible, and we can't make the public smarter than they are necessarily. And,
but you can train them, okay?
Well, no, but let me finish. Yeah. So when I talked about this on a previous episode, and I want to ask you about it. When I lived in New York, I saw it firsthand. Everybody reads the Daily News or the New York Post when they're on the subway. And so people talk about what's going on with the mayor of New York. Local politics is something that's always on everyone's mind. People know everything about it. And I think one of the reasons is the tabloids draw them in to begin with. And here in Los Angeles, your former home, and I hope you'll be returning soon, there's no tabloids. And do you recall, or have you been away so long that you don't remember, nobody knows anything about local politics here in Los Angeles. You follow what I'm saying?
I do hear what you're saying. And look, so I think there's a similar argument that's made about comedy programs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right. The Daily Show and Bill Maher.
When the Daily Show came on the scene, now, it's far better than a tabloid because it really does inform mm-hmm. people about the issues, and it has a reminder of the cost of some of these things. So I understand and agree with the point that it's better to have more people engaged than not. If you want to have a democratic government, you want people to at least pay attention and talk about things. Yeah, that's great. But do you really want people to vote based on those things? Well, you want them to think a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. No, I just said there is a positive side to it. Yeah. So I think ideally the way it would work, hopefully, is that some of this gossipy stuff pulls them in, and then they wind up getting interested in more substantive things.
I think that would be great.
This is in my dreams. Now, Geza is chomping at the bit. He wants to say something.
Well, I just want to interject one thing, which is that the substantive things just somehow never arrive, because the horse race, as you call it, which is a great term for it, I always was looking at it like a sports event or something like that. But the substantive information just never shows up anymore. There was a time when people, you know, they voted a lot more on the issues and also from their conscience. But now the whole point of all of the media and the political machine is to just draw people into one or the other of the two camps, and to drive everything else out, and to make sure that people vote in blocks on one or the other side of a very, very, you know, thinly disguised game of, you know, like, what is it, when the chickens fight to the death? What's it called? I don't know. But anyways.
So what about your show, Maria? I mean, it's called The Scholar Circle. How do you deal with exactly what we've just been talking about? What are the sort of the ground rules or the parameters of the tone and the content and the type of guests you book with respect to the media landscape in general?
Completely different. What we do is we usually pull in three scholars who study a similar issue from different perspectives. So whether it's police violence, and we might have a psychologist, a police scholar, and a law scholar on together, talking about the roots of the problem, the context of the problem, and the solution to the problem. The show that's coming up next, we have two scholars who study peace and peacemaking. And we'd be surprised to know that peace agreements have escalated in the last few years. Somebody actually tallied them by a massive amount. And why that is, and what kind of peace agreements stick, and how do you get to them, and, you know, those kinds of things that are substantive. You would hardly ever find them in most media. Look, I admittedly, I do, like I said, I read the New York Times on a daily basis, and they do have a good section on science. So I'm very happy about that. So, and we cover a lot of science. We cover a lot of politics, but it's always something more in depth, something that's peer reviewed, and something that means something bigger for our lives.
So you mentioned psychologists. I'm interested in booking psychologists, and I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. When you have them on, do they kind of assess what's going on in culture from a psychological perspective? Is that the angle?
There are some that do that. When I was talking about the police violence one, there are psychologists who specifically study police behavior, or in this case, it was latent. Like when you're not even aware that you might have a racial bias, it's very subconscious and how they actually address those things.
Right.
So that was an example. Yesterday, one of the psychologists we had on had been working on reconciliation after genocides like Rwanda, and talking about what it actually takes to reconcile when your whole family's been killed by the other side and now you have to live with them.
So, but do you also do what I asked about? In other words, you know, like if you talk, most people, like if you're talking to them about, you know, seeing a therapist, you know, and they're dealing with anxiety or they're in denial or whatever their issues are, people, you know, recognize that's a valid way to understand a problem with the goal of then you overcome it. And my feeling is we should do that more with societal problems. Yeah. And that's really what I want to do. So is there anybody who you could, you don't have to do it right now, but I would love if you could recommend anybody that might be a good guest who approaches it from that angle.
Like a cultural studies person is what you're looking for.
Yes, I think that would be about right. Right.
Yeah.
So before I let you go, I want to ask you something on a completely different topic, because when this occurred, I thought of you and I said, I wonder what Maria thinks. Were you familiar with the interview that Sean Penn did with El Chapo for Rolling Stone?
You know, I didn't actually read it, but I was aware that he had done the interview.
So you don't have to read it to answer this question, actually. I don't know if you're aware of it, but they gave approval of the interview to El Chapo. In other words, it could only be published with his approval. And some people said, oh, that's just not done in journalism, and they got very huffy about it. And before I give my opinion, let me just ask you your opinion about that. What do you think about that?
Well, so first of all, I think that I approve of him doing the interview in general. I think he even called it a failure, though, in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, you don't run it all by the person that you are interviewing, but sometimes that's the only way a journalist can get the interview.
Right.
So it's a little bit one of these things where you want to get the information out there. You don't want to give them a final word because then they get to shape the frame of the story to some extent. But this is what journalists deal with all the time. I'll give you an example. I have a book coming out this year that deals with journalists who cover what I call danger zones, whether it's a war or organized crime or whatever that is. Well, they have to be very careful to not get killed and to not go to prison and not get tortured. And in one case, the Vice News team went to North Korea and made a documentary about basketball diplomacy. They were the only journalism team to get into North Korea. But they had to follow a lot of protocol.
Right.
And these are the sort of things that you have to do if you want to at least get in. So instead of like covering something up, they actually made that control part of the story. So there are ways that it can be done. And some journalists can do it, and some journalists are not so great at it.
Perfect answer. I feel the same way. And I was kind of laughing at these old school people who are so prissy. And, you know, it's like a rule just because it has to be a rule. You know what I mean? And there really is nothing wrong with it because the reader is told, or, you know, was told in the case of the Rolling Stone article, and they can still make a judgment as to whether or not it seems like it was biased in this way or that way. So, you know, there's really no big downside to it. It's just
What I think a journalist has to do in that case is to say which parts have been controlled or whatever that happens to be.
If, yeah, in this case, El Chapo didn't ask for any corrections.
Yeah. So it's like it's the whole thing is about disclosure to your reader so that you are being totally honest with your audience, because that's what journalism is supposed to be based on, is a relationship between audience and content provider that is based on honesty and trust. And if you violate that trust, then who are you anymore as a journalist?
Right, right.
And so, yeah, you can do that, but you have to disclose it.
The other thing is the guy was on the lam, you know, so he might want to check the article to see if there's anything there that would give away where he is or anything like that. I mean, that's a side with the criminal, but it's kind of a reasonable consideration from his point of view anyway. All right, so that was an unexpected question, but I knew you could handle it. Marie Arimidian addressing El Chapo and Sean Penn out of left field. Marie, I know you're dealing with a tough situation in your personal life, so I really want to thank you for joining us. I love you, and all the best to you. Your website is just your last name. I mean, there is no other Arimidian besides you. It's Arimidian.com, and your book is great. I had the pleasure to work with you a little bit on arranging some events and publicity for that, and the title and the subtitle are fantastic, too. Listen to this, Gaza. Kill the Messenger is the title, and the subtitle is The Media's Role in the Fate of the World.
I was watching it on the screen. This is one of my favorite types of topic, and I was really excited about it.
You got to read
your
book.
Beautiful explanations, too. Thank you so much for your help.
Well, thank you.
Okay, Maria, take care, and let's do a Skype off the air with video.
It sounds great.
Okay,
nice
beautiful.
To talk with you.
Thank
okay.
you. Take care. Bye. Maria Arimidian, everybody. I said I want to try to get the blog post. I said is called American Spring. The guy's first name is Naval. Startupboy.com. Maybe I don't even have his last name here. I thought I did. But if you go to startupboy.com, you can read American Spring. It's not long. It's not particularly difficult. Very easy read, but it just makes a really great point about where we're at right now.
I'm very interested in that book of hers, too. I'd like to read that.
Okay. I may be able to help you out with that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Cool.
So, we were talking about Trump and hypnosis and, you know, just what a brilliant tactic. By the way, let me give out the phone number here. Hopefully I can find that. 800-893-9562, 800-893-9562. Give us a call if you want to chat with us about just about anything. So there was, we were talking about his persuasion techniques 2 weeks ago, and the other day, Joe Scarborough, who hosts Morning Joe on MSNBC, mm-hmm. was going on about how skilled Trump is. And it reminded me very much of what we were talking about. So I just wanted to show that clip and then have a little chat about it.
Nice.
Jeremy, are you on the scene? Oh, there you go.
And Ted Cruz have been fighting for some time. And I've been saying this over the past week or two, that Donald Trump has been absolutely masterful, putting Ted Cruz back on his heels. Trump ahead 37%.
A little dastardly, too.
26%. Marco Rubio, 14. Nobody else even close. First,
hey, Jeremy, can you do
you
that
had,
image?
Of course, Jeb
Not
Bush,
right now, but are
who's
you able
the prohibited favorite.
The GM is just like
Donald Trump, like a laser, focused and hit him every day. Mm-hmm. Low-energy candidate. It became a part of the political lexicon, mm-hmm. and you could not look at Jeb Bush without thinking he's a low-energy candidate. Masterful. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Then Ben Carson goes ahead of him in Iowa. Donald Trump's ahead in 49 states. That's not good enough for him. You remember what he did, talking about the guy bragging about hitting his mother in a head? Remember that? Mm-hmm. Everybody thought that was a terrible speech. I said in real time it was a masterful speech with a belt buckle.
Mm-hmm.
Because
oh my gosh.
It looked
the
like theater.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like it was absurd.
Funny.
Well,
I
and
think
all
was
that
criticized
did,
for attacking Iowans. But yes, the
but
Ben
all
Carson
that did
stuck,
was
right.
underline how absurd Ben Carson,
right.
the central
in a way no one else
right.
could.
So that's a second.
Right?
That's a second one. Two masterful takedowns of opponents.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz gets in his way, and he sits back, and then he drops the Canadian thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just, it's not like a virus that spreads slowly. It's just, it's like kudzu that's just grown slowly across the Iowa landscape and across America for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Cruz has been on the defensive for the first time in his political life, and he's been on the defensive for over 2 weeks now. Probably the most effective counterpunch, and that was to Hillary Clinton. So put the Clinton machine back on their heels for weeks. The New York Times is still writing stories about how Hillary is losing younger women because of questions about how she treated women in the 1990s. I'm sorry, I can't think of another politician in our lifetime that has had the gut instinct to destroy his opponents this way.
Wow.
Is that what we call cognitive dissonance when you say wow?
So, no, it's funny, but no, it's a pretty telling thing that they really broke it down pretty well. But
And I have to apologize for not killing the mic before I shut it out to Jeremy. Luckily, it was a fairly lengthy clip, so even though I talked over part of it, you could still hear most of it. But go on. What's behind your wow?
I just think that it's really, really very, very well broken down as far as him trying to take down the opposition sort of one thing at a time. It's odd, really, when you look at it, because his showmanship is outweighing what would be, I mean, Ted Cruz, you know, is by far the most presidential Republican candidate as far as having the manners and the poise and the smoothness and the his eye on the issues. And,
really?
I think
what about Rubio? I'm not giving my preference.
Rubio's a little more street, a little more clunky. You know, that's I'm not even taking sides. I'm really looking at this very, very coldly.
Yeah.
But as far as having the poise and the ability to come back real quickly when he's to think on his feet and to Cruz is intelligent and, for the Republican Party on a pretty conservative side of things, he's a great candidate. And
he's going to have an opportunity tomorrow night with Trump pulling out of the debate. Cruz is getting center stage.
He's really going to try and take advantage of that. And I hope he does. I'm not rooting for anybody in particular. I'm just saying that, let the strongest forces prevail. And he's challenging Donald Trump, he sent him a letter just a few hours ago saying, "Dear Donald, we owe it to the men and women of Iowa to ensure that they hear jointly and directly from the two leading Republican candidates." So he's challenging him to a head-on
mano
debate,
to mano.
Mano a mano.
Yeah.
Because Cruz feels that as far as being a debater, he might be able to outshine Trump. Trump, on the other hand, has what you might call the negotiating acumen and a lot of the staging and hypnosis that you were talking about. So that would be an interesting thing. I don't know what's going to happen, but I thought that was a really strong move from Cruz.
Right. Now, Scarborough was just talking about how Trump has taken down the others, including Cruz. And one way he's gone after Cruz is to make an issue of whether or not he's qualified.
Legally,
because he was born in Canada. So do you think that any of the other candidates will make an issue out of that? And
they haven't. They've been a little bit more gentlemanly about it. Trump's just
I'm talking about specifically to Marinette. With Trump not being there, in other words, do you think somebody will sort of fill the void? And
I decline to make a prediction on that particular topic. Because
you must. I insist.
My prediction is that they are going to try and gather together and appear a little bit more courteous towards one another with Trump out of the picture to make Trump look, to try and lower Trump's value because Trump is outspoken and he's a loudmouth and he's, kind of a thug. So I think that their best strategy would be to look all shiny and poised and polite.
Doesn't sound like much of a strategy to me. Maybe for Cruz, because he's running more or less neck and neck with Trump, but how are the others going to gain any ground if all they are is polite?
I see what you're saying. Well, I don't know. Good question. You held my feet to the fire, and that's all that came out.
Hey, that's all right.
Squeak.
So on the other side, on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, has been a guy who paints himself as running a very clean campaign, not negative ads and all that, and that's not entirely true. but it's, I suppose, mostly true. And I think he's benefited from Trump destroying the Clintons. So he's kind of lucky in that regard. But I want to say a few words about Bernie Sanders. He's kind of annoying. And I said a little bit earlier about how, this guy walks on water in the eyes of the Sandersnistas. And I mentioned earlier that nobody's giving him any grief for pulling out of the debate. And by the way, the RNC got rid of NBC because they didn't like the moderators, which is, as far as I see, exactly the same thing, mm-hmm. as Trump is doing. But nobody made a big issue out of that and said, they're fraidy cats and this is the wrong thing and so forth. But when Trump does it, they react differently. And Sanders, again, maybe not, it might be because all the news with Trump has kind of buried that Sanders is saying he won't participate in this debate. But the other thing that annoys me about Sanders is he is an authoritarian in his own way. And Trump and the Republicans in general are often correctly characterized as authoritarians. Certainly Trump has an authoritarian bent that I find very distasteful. But Sanders is also has that side to him. It's just a different brand, different issues. In particular, he is in favor of terrorism suspects being placed on a watch list that deprives them of their constitutional right to own a gun. And there's no other constitutional right that I know of in the history of this country, not a right that's explicitly granted in the Constitution, that anybody has ever tried to say, no, you're not entitled to that right without any kind of judicial ruling. And that's what this watch list is. They're saying just because the government brands you to be a shady character, you can't buy a gun. And I think it's obviously because people are very emotional about guns, and that's fine. Except that, what about the Constitution? What about due process? And what really annoys me is that people like Sanders don't even feel a need to acknowledge that. They think it should just be understood that, hey, you know, guns are a bad thing, so no need to even explain this thing that's unprecedented. And the other thing, of course, is Citizens United. Sanders fails to explain exactly what he has in mind with that. And we're supposed to just assume, you know, he assumes that we already know what's in his head, and the Supreme Court made a very, very bad decision. There's no need to even confront the reasoning, and let's just go into protest mode. But the fact is, the plaintiffs made a big issue, and I think they made a very strong argument about how it just wasn't clear what is subject to regulation, what isn't, what kind of spending can you restrict, and who, what kind of spenders can you restrict versus which kind can't you? And in particular, the media, the press, there's freedom of the press. Everybody seems to agree that the press shouldn't be regulated. In other words, the New York Times shouldn't be subject to complex and burdensome election laws where you have to hire lawyers just to figure out how to comply with these laws. And Bernie Sanders has never even tried to explain who gets to have the same rights as the New York Times. It's just never explained. And this is irritating, and I want to address this. And I have an idea, and it kind of ties into our theme today. But first, let's run a little clip of Justice Antonin Scalia, whom a lot of people think is an obnoxious guy. And this is him being interviewed by, what's the British guy's name? He used to be on CNN. I can't think of his name, but it doesn't matter. Jeremy, can you run that clip of Justice Scalia?
Let's turn to political fundraising, which at the moment, under your interpretation, I believe, of the Constitution, you should be allowed to raise money for a political party. The problem, as I see it, many critics see it, is that it has no limitation to it. So what you've now got are these super PACs funded by billionaires effectively trying to buy elections. And that cannot have been what the founding fathers intended. Thomas Jefferson didn't sit there constructing something which was going to be abused in that kind of way. And I do think it's been abused, don't you?
No, I think Thomas Jefferson would have said the more speech, the better. That's what the First Amendment is all about. So long as the people know where the speech is coming from.
But it's not speech when I'm talking about money to back up the speech.
You can't separate speech from the money that facilitates the speech.
Can't you?
It's utterly impossible. Could you tell newspaper publishers you can only spend so much money in the publication of your newspaper? Would they not say this is abridging my speech?
Yeah, but newspaper publishers aren't buying elections. I mean, to the election of a president, as you know better than anybody else, you've served under many of them, is an incredibly important thing.
Newspapers.
It shouldn't be susceptible to the highest bidder, should it?
Newspapers endorse political candidates all the time. What do you mean they're almost in the business of doing that?
Yes.
And are you going to limit the amount of money they can spend on it?
Do you think perhaps?
Surely not.
Do you think perhaps they should be?
Oh, I certainly think not. I think, as I think the framers thought, that the more speech, the better. Now, you are entitled to know where the speech is coming from. Information as to who contributed what, that's something else. But whether they can speak is, I think, clear in the First Amendment.
So, Scalise,
well.
he made one of the points I just made, you know, about newspaper publishers. So, again, the question is, who gets to have the same rights as the New York Times? Well, go ahead, what?
Just, I mean, there's some slippery concatenation going on there with him because he's making it seem a lot more innocent and a lot more public than it actually is. And newspapers...
What do you mean a lot more public?
Well, he's making it into a thing where this is the freedom of speech of the public. And the more speech, the better. The more opportunities for free speech, the better.
Well, he was asked what he thinks Jefferson had in mind.
Newspaper, when a newspaper, endorses a candidate, it's eminently clear what they're doing. They have, it's written up, it's, you know, you can see it right in the, it's just, there's no question about it.
Right.
When
but
a
this,
super
but,
PAC
well, you're talking about
the frames advertisements on a television station and pays for all of these advertisements under some kind of phony name, like the Citizens for Wonderfulness of the Truth of the World, it gets a little slippery because people don't have time to do their research. And this is one of the places where the public is getting screwed, really, is in the inability to do the research necessary to understand who they're being manipulated by and to what extent. A lot of times, it seems like these are, that's when I said public, it seems like these are populist movements and that these are, issues that are brought together by a group of people. And yeah, it's a group of people. It can be a corporation. It can be a corporation speaking for what? All of their employees.
Right, but the kind of conversation you're having right now with me is the kind of conversation we could have in a bar, coffee house, whatever, right? It doesn't mean that it translates to the courtroom, okay? We could be in a bar talking about Fox News and MSNBC, and we can understand that there's a big difference between their sort of very biased journalism and say, you know, PBS or the New York Times. We see that difference, but how do you then go into court and draw a distinction between who has the right and who doesn't? So let's just say, for the sake of this discussion, what you just said is completely correct. You still have to come back to, well, then therefore what? What do you do about it? Who has the right and who doesn't? And this is what Sanders is avoiding.
Let's reverse the whole paradigm for a moment. Instead of looking at it from the bottom up, from the public standpoint, let's look at it from the standpoints of a large multinational corporation that really doesn't owe much allegiance to the United States at all. It's got all of its operations in multiple countries, but mostly outside. Let's say they've outsourced everything to other countries, and they're not really an American corporation, mm-hmm. but they're able to spend a tremendous amount of money and create the illusion that they're supporting a premise that is in the public's interest and pour an amazing amount of money into it that no one can really compete with, that a group of public-minded citizens can't even attempt to touch.
Right. Well, Scalia just said it's impossible, and instead of telling me how it's possible, you're telling me what your concerns are, and that's exactly my point. What I don't mean this in a rude way.
No,
I would say this about myself. I would say it about anybody. It's like, why are your feelings and worries important? I mean, they're important.
No. I get exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Is there any point at which you, meaning anybody, are going to get around to saying what to do about it? Okay. This comes. I don't want to get into the weeds too much on the minutia of law, but it is pretty simple. Actually, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that what this is about is a judge needs to have some rationale when the argument comes before them. People are going to say, hey, I'm not in that class that's regulated. Or they're going to say, hey, I spent some money, but it's not the type of spending that's subject to regulation according to your legislation. And a judge needs a way to say, something to base that on and say, you're right, you win. If you can't tell a judge how to do that, and the judge is saying, which is what the Supreme Court majority justices are saying, that we don't see a way to do it, why are you blaming the Supreme Court? You follow what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but when these
Who gets to have the rights that the New York Times has? Just answer the question. You know what I mean?
No, I get it.
Yeah. All right, so I want to show a little meme. The memes are sometimes they go viral. They're a real big thing. And it's kind of relevant in a few different ways because it has to do with spending and politics. So much on social media is now costs almost nothing, And I made this meme myself. I'm now a meme maker. And I want to try and get it out there as a little experiment and see. Because people, their brains fog over when you talk about all the legal considerations in Citizens United. So Jeremy, if you could show that on the screen. I tried to come up with a way to make a point here that's not too complicated. And one of the things that the critics of the court always do is they say it's a right-wing thing. The court is, biased for Republicans, biased for business. But they conveniently ignore the fact that some very well-known, reputable liberals, such as Eliot Spitzer and Glenn Greenwald, as well as the ACLU and others, agree with the court. And it's really a struggle to get the critics of the court to be honest about this and face it. And it's frustrating to me. So I'm going to try to get this out there virally. And I'm going to just do it by, declaring I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to ask people to help me get this around.
It's an interesting spin. I like it.
Yeah. And it says, Jeremy, is this showing now?
Yeah,
to the
it says program.
Okay, good. So feel the spurn. Sanders wants to overturn Citizens United. Glenn Greenwald, Eliot Spitzer, and the ACLU say he's wrong. And so far, this has not been a big issue in the campaign, but I think it might be eventually because Sanders has proposed a constitutional amendment that would authorize Congress to regulate anything that's spent by anyone on anything that might somehow affect an election. And that is just so wrong. It's so broad. There's no limits on it at all. And I just think that makes him an authoritarian. And I don't, to say that me and my fellow Americans might have to go to prison because we're spending money on sharing an opinion or distributing information, I don't want to leave it up to the government. Yeah, what do you want to say?
Well, only the same thing that I would say, when Trump is speaking or Cruz is speaking, which is that, we've been reduced to sort of horse race politics, and there isn't time for a person like Bernie Sanders or anyone else to break down what it is that they're talking about and explain sort of like the sub-themes and all of the different ways that it would sort itself out or regulate the regulations. So he has an idea, you hear it in the broad strokes, same way that, Trump said that, we got to control immigration and the broad strokes.
No, but it's not the same. You unwittingly made my point because, I'll tell you
no,
what.
No, I'm fine.
Because Sanders proposed a constitutional amendment. I think it's fine to do it in the context of campaigning. Mm-hmm. Everybody is vague when they're campaigning. But when you're proposing a constitutional amendment and trying to actually get it passed, and the consequence, if passed, will be people will go to prison or be silenced if under the threat of imprisonment.
I haven't seen the amendment. So.
Yeah, okay, well, I will pointed out to you. That's exactly what it says. No limits at all. Anybody
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And he's never been made to explain that. And I think when people are going to prison or being threatened with imprisonment, you better explain it. And that is authoritarian. Anyway, Geza, thank you very much.
Sure.
And you'll be with us, not necessarily every week, but you're a very unpredictable guy.
Sure.
And Maria Armudian, thank you. Thanks to Maria for joining us. And also, I'd like to welcome our new producer, Donna Bummer, who's on the scene, and Jeremy Hansen, the head honcho of We Play Radio.
Yeah, we love you, Jeremy.
The website is weplayradio.com. And our website for the show is normanreport.com. We're on every Wednesday, 7 o'clock Pacific time, 10 o'clock Eastern time. Thank you all for tuning in. This is Jeff Norman saying love ya.
Jeff Norman, the Norman Report.